The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So often in the teachings here, we do talk about meeting our human experience. As I described in the guided meditation, that is what we're doing. We are exploring with mindfulness what it means to be a human being. And sometimes as we do that, we do run into struggle. We run into difficulty, maybe even more than sometimes. That there's pain in our bodies and we react to it. There's something that happened with our friends that we got frustrated about, and that memory comes up in meditation and we feel that frustration all over again. And so there's this encouragement to open to struggle, stress, suffering. And this is, in some ways, this is the framing of the Buddha's teaching. He talks a lot about the teachings of the Buddha are kind of organized around recognizing suffering in the human condition, that it is a normal part of our human condition, but that it's not something that we have to be caught by or struggle with, and that there's a way that we can understand suffering and release it. We can begin to understand how it's put together in our minds. And it's not just about having unpleasant experience. That is not what the Buddha meant by suffering, because unpleasant experience will continue in our lives. And yet we can have some ease around unpleasant experience. There doesn't have to be reactivity or frustration or anger around unpleasant experience. And around pleasant experience, there doesn't have to be this sense of, oh, need to keep that, hold on to it, need to construct my life in a certain way to have all of these pleasant things. You know, this is so much what our culture teaches us. You know, from the moments we're ready to take in information from around us, it's telling us the way to be happy is to get things that we want and get rid of things that we don't want. And this is what we learn. So it's very natural that we learn this. And yet the Buddha discovered in his own experience that there's something a kind of a deeper possibility for happiness that transcends all of the, you know, stuff of life, and that it is possible to live in the midst of everything that's happening and have ease and peace. That not meaning that we're just non-reactive. Ease and peace doesn't mean indifference. Ease and peace doesn't mean non-action. But it does mean, or it has a sense of stepping into action with a heart that is open rather than constricted. A heart that is open and available to respond rather than with this agenda of I have to get rid of. And so this is a lot of what we explore here in our in our practice and what we talk about in our teachings. What does it mean to meet this suffering? What does it mean to understand it? And how does that help us to let go and to come into a new relationship with being human? I really think that's a lot of what our practice is about, coming into a new relationship with being human. There's another side to the Buddhist teaching around the possibility of freedom, the possibility of the mind that meets the world in this way. That unconstricted heart, that heart that is responsive rather than reactive. This is what we could say, that the qualities that begin to show up as we get curious about our human experience. There are a whole bunch of really beautiful qualities that we can both begin to recognize and begin to cultivate. There's a list that I wanted to start exploring with you. It's a long list. It's 10 things in this list. It's called the 10 perfections. The Pali word is parami, 10 perfections. And I'll just tell you first what they are. They're generosity, ethics, renunciation, or we could say letting go, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. And these 10 qualities they're kind of the qualities that are supported and cultivated as we engage in this practice. And so sometimes we can think of the practice as being what I do is open to this human experience and see what's here. And that's a lot of what happens in mindfulness practice. And yet we can also begin to explore or be curious about the beautiful qualities of heart and mind and begin to kind of incline in that direction, because the teaching also says these qualities both result from the willingness to explore our hearts and minds and begin to be curious about this new way of relating to being human that's responsive rather than reactive. And so as we're willing to explore that, some of these qualities begin to happen to us. They begin to strengthen. And we can, so that they come along for the ride in our practice, but they also can be thought of in some ways as a description of what it means to be free and in this responsive rather than reactive place. So it's worth exploring these qualities, rather than thinking about our practice being, the whole framework of the Buddhist teachings, as I said, is in the Four Noble Truths, it's around suffering. There's the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of, thank goodness, freedom is possible from suffering, and there's a path leading to freedom from suffering, but the entire thing is framed around suffering. And so it's like, where is the good stuff, you know? Where is the stuff that, brings joy and delight and happiness? And this list is some of that. And we can think about the practice being both on the side of opening to, starting to let go of the ways that we react, and turning towards cultivating these beautiful qualities of heart and mind. In the in Asian countries, one of the things that the monasteries there are really, they're community centers, much like this center is in some ways, and there are people that practice there. Sometimes they're retreat centers and monasteries. There's often a lead monk, a teacher at the monastery, and that teacher is both guiding the people who are there in intensive practice, but also meets people from the community who show up and ask questions about their lives. Often the relationship between these teachers and the people in the community is around a discussion about these paramis, to explore, how's your patience? What are you noticing about patience these days? Or how about truthfulness? Are you engaging with a practice around truthfulness? Or love? Are you engaging with exploring that open heart? And so in Burma, where I have practiced, these qualities. These paramis are understood in many ways to be the ground of our daily life practice. And so since this is a community here, this is a great list for us to explore, because these qualities are not just about what gets cultivated in our meditation when we're sitting still with our eyes closed, but what's happening in relationship. In relationship with other people, in relationship with the world, in relationship with ourselves. So that's why I'd like to explore these with you. So tonight I'd just like to kind of do an overview, talk about each of them briefly, a little bit about how they kind of fit together, ways to think about practicing with them. One of the things I love about parami practice and daily life practice in general is that creativity rules. It's like, there's no, like, you know, we sit in meditation, there's all kinds of instructions, you know, pay attention to your breath, or pay attention to breath and hearing, or do loving kindness meditation, or so there's specific instructions in the sitting meditation. But in daily life we really have to get creative. How do we create a practice for generosity? How do we create a practice for patience? You know, what in daily life, not just on the cushion. And so this has been a big part of my own practice, the exploration of creativity around these paramis. There is a kind of an understanding of these paramis as being a sequence in a way, that they build on each other, they support each other, that you know, generosity in some ways is kind of the ground of practice, and often the Buddha began, especially for lay people, for community members, speaking about generosity as being a really helpful place to begin the practice. Generosity and ethics as being a helpful place to begin the practice. And these set the stage for kind of an appreciation for the value of letting go, and what this how this supports this transition in our hearts from this idea that happiness comes from getting everything that I want and getting rid of things that I don't want. You know, as we start to engage in a more generous and ethical way in the world, we begin to recognize there's some, maybe some other values, and this is connected with renunciation and wisdom. And so there is this kind of understanding of a flow from one to the other. But really, I think about these 10 paramis as being more like they're strands in a cable that are interwoven and supporting each other. We can talk about them as leading one to the other, and given that I have to talk about them in some way, that's how I'll talk about them. But keep it in mind that it's not like we first work on generosity and then move to ethics. In fact, in daily life practice, when I encourage people to explore these, I encourage people, you know, listen to all of these. I'll talk a little bit about each one tonight, and which one sparks your interest? Which one is the one that feels most interesting or curious for you? Maybe it's patience, or maybe it's energy, or maybe it's love. And then seeing if there can be a way to creatively engage with that. So, I'll talk a little bit about each one. So generosity, I think both generosity and ethics are the ground of relationship. You know, the ground of our relationship with other people and other beings, not just people, but all beings, that we explore what it means to be generous in our life. So generosity, this act of giving, this the parami is actually the parami of giving. And it's about learning both about the joy of offering to someone else. And this is actually pretty natural. I mean, we see it in kids. Sometimes we see it in kids, you know, that they kind of naturally want to share things, but then they want them back. You know, I see this in little kids, you know, they really want to give it away, but then they want you to give it back to them. But there's this kind of movement to share. And there can be a joy to that, a joy to the offering, a joy to seeing somebody appreciate a gift. And the understanding of generosity and its place in the practice in some ways is that it is, you know, a recognition first of relationship, of right relationship. And this I really want to emphasize, you know, the teachings, as we brought them to the West, we really emphasized the meditation part of the teachings, but the actual fullness of the teaching includes all of our lives. It's not limited to sitting with our eyes closed, but it includes how we are engaged in the world. So really this practice of giving explores a connection, a relationship with others, and a seeing of how it feels when giving, and I think also this probably includes receiving, because generosity, in order to be fully explored, needs to be explored on both sides. And sometimes it's easier to give things than it is to receive them. You know, sometimes we have trouble with the receiving side of it. And so both sides, looking at the giving and the receiving in this practice of giving, of generosity. And there's so many things giving, you know, this isn't just about money and material goods. I think at the deeper levels, this is about giving of our time, giving of our hearts, giving of the best of us. In some ways, you know, our practice, how we show up for the world, how we engage with each other, you know, the gift of being kind to somebody can be an act of generosity. A smile can be an act of generosity. This relationship, and we see how it impacts connection, how it impacts relationship. At one point I was practicing this smiling. I was taking walks and seeing what happened if I smiled at everybody I met. And I didn't force the smile on people, you know. I didn't like try to make them have eye contact with me, but you know, I would just if they happened to look up and see me, and make eye contact with me, I would smile. I would consciously smile, and you know, I don't know of any time that somebody didn't smile back, and it was amazing. Actually, it was the most happy thing. To be walking around for that half hour each morning and smiling at people. At one point, I even got curious. It's like, wow, this feels really good. This is simple. You know, this is a simple thing that I'm doing. I'm smiling at people. And they're smiling back. I feel like I'm getting way more than I'm giving. I actually even timed it at one point, you know. Makes me really happy to receive that smile back. How long does that happiness last? It lasted like 40 seconds. You know, I didn't like try to make it stay, but it's just like, you know, there's just this warm, good feeling of a feeling of delight and joy, and I just checked it out. It's like, wow, a smile, 40 seconds of happiness for a smile. And so we begin to see how we impact each other. It also begins to touch into a beginning of the teaching around the deeper teachings around why we struggle so much in our lives. You know, with the teaching around suffering, I was talking around earlier, the Buddha, you know, encouraged us to understand suffering. And a lot of our suffering has to do with wanting to hold on to things, you know, this clinging, this wanting things to be a certain way, either to get rid of things that we don't like or to hold on to things that we like. Either way, there's a kind of a clinging. For myself, it was kind of hard to understand at first why pushing something away would be clinging. But then I discovered it was like I was like, you know, if I don't like this cushion, it's like I was stuck to this cushion trying to get rid of it, you know. So I was like clinging to the cushion trying to get rid of it. So there's a way in which both the wanting to hold on to things and wanting to get rid of things has a stickiness to it. And the act of generosity is a direct exploration of letting go. What is it? How do we relate to letting go? And that it can be a joyful thing to let go. It becomes more that we see what we have in our lives as resource that can be shared. And what do we want to nourish with our resources? Not what can I keep so that I have everything for myself, but how can the wider world benefit? What do I want to nourish with my resources? The second of the paramis of ethics. And in one way to just kind of explore how they connect one to the other. The gift of ethics, in a way, exploring ethics is exploring non-harming. We explore what it means to engage in the world in a way that doesn't create suffering in the world. So non-harming, it makes perfect sense that non-harming is a value if what we're looking at is how does suffering get created. If we are interested in how suffering gets created in this being, then we want to look at and explore not adding suffering to the world through harming other human beings, even as best we can, non-human beings. I mean, there's almost no way to live on this planet without creating some harm. I mean, you know, even picking vegetables and eating them, some beings are dying in this process. And yet the exploration around harming here, it's not... You know, we can't hold it so tightly in a way that we feel that no being can be harmed in my life. But what we do explore is this, is there a movement in the heart that wishes to create harm? And, you know, this can be very humbling, you know, when we start to see this. You know, we're basically good people here, you know, it's and yet when we look in our minds, I had a real humbling experience of this when I was first starting to practice. I was looking at the anger, I was really watching anger and noticing how I was angry at a particular person, and I was watching everything that was coming up in my mind around anger. And at one point, as I was noticing the anger about this particular person or for this particular person, I noticed in my heart this wish that that person be in some way made miserable. I wished that person to be, I don't think that I would go so far as to say harmed, but I really wished that they wouldn't be happy, you know? And I really kind of wanted them to be miserable because I was miserable. I felt like I was miserable because of something that person had done, and I wanted them to be miserable. And that was like really humbling in that moment, seeing it so clearly with mindfulness, seeing that heart that wanted another being to be miserable. It's like, wow. You know, this is where war comes from. This movement of heart that's contracted and wants somebody to not be happy, wants somebody to be miserable, in fact. So it can be very humbling to see that these urges exist in our hearts. And what our encouragement is in this practice is, again, as I said in the guided meditation, we're opening to the fullness of our human experience. And there's a big difference, a huge difference, between with humility recognizing, yeah, wanting that person to be miserable is arising in this heart right now. Seeing that with humility and recognizing this is a human experience. And feeling the heart that goes, ugh, when it really sees that. Not to repress it, not to tell yourself you're a bad person for it, but to recognize, oh, it's like this when the heart does this. So to be honest with ourselves, and that's one of the other paramis, this truthfulness, to be really honest with ourselves, this is what's happening right now. Huge difference between that recognition of this is the human experience of wanting someone to be miserable, feeling into that fully, and basically wanting them to be miserable and acting out on that. Vastly different. In one case, we are fully buying in to that movement of mind, entrenching that pattern in our own hearts. In the other, we're seeing how the heart itself feels, oh, you know, that this ethical exploration begins to open us to the recognition that our hearts actually have an ethical compass in there. It helps us to recognize when, oh, that's not a good direction. That's not helpful. That creates harm in the world. That creates harm for me. That creates harm for others. There's this warning mechanism in there. And when we can open to that and not be ashamed or fearful or rejecting of it, it can help to steer us in a more in a direction that heads more towards non-harm. And so if we hold this value of non-harming and we engage in this as a practice, it's again, you know, we're not going to be perfect at it. Definitely not going to be perfect at it. The one piece I wanted to point to is that we're not going to be perfect at it, and beings are going to be harmed in some ways through our living. I mean, if we walk across the lawn, we may be stepping on thousands of ants. You know, that is, you know, harm that comes to those beings. And yet, it is not our intention in walking across the lawn to create that harm. And so a lot of this exploration around ethics, we are exploring this, you know, is it that we are wanting to create harm and following through on that intention? We do that sometimes, you know. If there's a spider in our house, we may like reach up and, you know, smash it with a shoe. Now that is an intention to cause harm, right? That's got that heart of rejection to that being. Another alternative would be to trap it and put it outside. You know, so there are different ways we can be with those beings. So the difference between walking across a lawn and killing a spider unintentionally, one that you don't know is there, and picking up a shoe and smashing it in your house, very big difference also in the mind. One has the mind of anger, rejection. The other has basically is not aware of the action that it's doing. Now, this is something to be careful about here, because, you know, there are ways in which we can create harm in the world and not do it intentionally. You know, it's like You know, things happen as a result of our actions. And, you know, if we just simply feel like, well, I didn't intend for that to happen, so, you know, it's no problem. That also isn't what the Buddha asked us to do. He really asked us to explore, if harm is caused, if we become aware that harm is caused, is there something that we can learn and begin to shift our actions around? And so the example, you know, if you find out that, you know, spiders live all over, this is a simple, silly kind of example, but if spiders live all over the lawn, and pretty much every time you walk across the lawn, you're going to be killing a bunch of spiders, maybe you could take the sidewalk. You know, again, a silly example, but a kind of a learning. If you're not aware of the harm that you're causing, but then you discover, oh, there's harm being caused, this is something to learn from. This is a place to begin to explore. This is a huge part of, you know, terrain around, you know, the global warming, you know, for example. You know, we are beginning to understand that the way we've consumed resources is creating harm to the planet. You know, we didn't initially understand that. And now we do. It's very hard to change our patterns, and yet imperative for us if we're going to survive. So this is the kind of exploration we can make around non-harming. You know, to not just simply say, oh, well, it's not my intention for the polar bears to be dying, you know. Well, okay, we now know that the polar bears are dying. What can we do? How can we change our actions? So as we explore this, you know, non-harming approach to our lives, the connection to generosity, and if we think about generosity and in some ways each of these, one of the teachings around each of these is the one following. So ethical conduct, it's said to perfect generosity. This is one of the reasons they're called the perfections. So ethical conduct perfects generosity because it's said that the offering of ethical conduct is one of the greatest gifts that we can give. When we engage with this heart of non-harming, we give the gift of fearlessness, because people do not need to be afraid, beings do not need to be afraid in our presence. And so this is a connection between generosity and ethics. So I'm going to have to speed up here to get through the last 7, 8. Renunciation. This one, I'm going to spend some more time on each of these. So, renunciation. You know, this is a hard one for us, and I will save some of this for a few weeks from now. You know, renunciation does not have a good reputation in our country or in our culture. It's got this connection of giving things up that we like, you know. And yet what the exploration around renunciation is in practice is beginning to see that certain ways that we have engaged, you know, so like this pattern, as we start to see the pattern of, you know, thinking that happiness comes from getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want, and begin perhaps to touch into a deeper recognition that there's something more, a heart that's not so oriented around getting and getting rid of. There's a peace there or an ease there that is deeper than that happiness that comes from getting what we want. So we may start to touch into that a little bit. And with that recognition that there's a deeper happiness than the simple way that we've kind of explored throughout most of our lives, we may begin to see the value. It's like there's a teaching that if somebody understands that a greater happiness is possible by giving up a lesser happiness, the wise person will give up the lesser happiness in order to touch into the greater happiness. And this is the terrain of renunciation. It's not just simply about giving things up. You know, it's one teacher, basically, Bhikkhu Bodhi is a great scholar, translator of the Buddhist texts, and he offers this exploration around renunciation that says, you know, real renunciation isn't about like letting go of things that we still inwardly want, but really about the letting go that happens as we see those things no longer have the value that we thought they did. And so this is the direction of renunciation. This takes some wisdom, the next parami, to begin to touch into that possibility for a deeper kind of happiness. The whole of the teachings of the Buddha are really framed around the wisdom as it's related to suffering. The wisdom as it's related to this very simple mechanism that we've been talking about, the simple mechanism of the belief that we have that happiness comes from getting what we want, getting rid of what we don't want. Having, not just things, but having people think certain things about us, you know, having certain status, or, you know, that seems to be a big thing that we navigate our lives around. Having people have certain opinions about us. And, you know, we spend a little bit of time looking at our own minds and how changeable they are. You know, how much suffering comes from trying to arrange what other people think of us. You know, what a hopeless project. So, again, the teaching of the Buddha is around there's another possibility for happiness, a different way of being that comes from the heart that wants things to be a certain way is a constricted heart. It's constricted with greed, with aversion, with confusion. And the heart that is non-constricted, that heart has wisdom. That heart is available to meet the world in a new way. And the wisdom of letting go, of acting from greed, aversion, and delusion, and moving towards non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, we begin to move in this direction, not through just saying to ourselves, oh, greed, aversion, and delusion, get rid of them. You know, that's just another form of aversion. But through the direct exploration in our experience of, oh, right, this is the human experience of aversion. This is the human experience of wanting things to be a certain way and feeling into the way the heart is kind of tight around that, fearful around what it's going to lose. The heart that can relax is a heart that feels more peace and ease in all of our activities, in all of our days. And this learning, it's not an easy learning. It comes from being willing to look at the human experience. Again, look at the human experience. This is what it feels like to be a human being that wants things to be other than they are. Again, the vast difference between opening to that, this is the human experience of that, and believing I need to have things the way I want them to be. So that switch or that willingness to turn with mindfulness, this is what this human experience is. This begins to point us in the direction of the wisdom that the Buddha means in this parami. Wisdom, it's interesting. When I first heard this word wisdom, I was thinking like it's some grand thing, you know. It actually is this really simple moment-to-moment understanding of this experience can be held with kindness. This experience can be known. Anger can be known. And in a moment of being mindful to something like anger, oh, anger is happening. We know it's a human experience of anger. We know it's conditioned. We don't take it personally, but we just know it. Oh, this is the human experience of anger. In that moment, there can be a kind of some space or a sense of the heart not being quite so constricted around it. And in that moment of the heart not feeling so constricted around that anger, that is wisdom at work in the moment. It's a little bit of letting go of the identification or the ownership of I'm angry and I need to do something about it to, oh, this is just the experience of anger. So it's wisdom at work in that moment. It comes in very moment-to-moment ways. Then there's energy. You know, wisdom can be directly experienced in this way that I just described, for instance, seeing a kind of shift of relationship to a difficult experience or opening to something and recognizing this is okay, it's not a problem. Seeing sometimes that, you know, something that we've been reacting to and suddenly we recognize, oh, this is just confusion happening and it's not particularly a problem. So we can see these shifts directly. And we can also take in information. You know, wisdom comes in a gradual way. We hear teachings. We understand something, learn something from a talk or from reading a book. And then we maybe begin to apply it, begin to be curious about, you know, how might that work? You know, this is how my own practice began. Somebody sent me a book, and it's like, don't know how that's going to work, but maybe I can give it a try. And so learning, taking in some wisdom from outside, and then putting it into practice. This is what the energy is about. We take what we learn, and we put it into practice. So we start to engage with those teachings. That begins to actually show us the possibility of, you know, as it doesn't actually take that long. I mean, when I first started this, you know, this somebody sent me this book and I read this book saying, well, try paying attention to your difficult emotions instead of acting on them. It's like, okay, I don't know how that's going to work, but I'll give it a try. So, I mean, I was in some ways fortunate that I'd kind of hit bottom at that moment. And so it's like nothing else had worked. So this very counterintuitive instruction of notice that you're angry. It's like, oh, I don't know how that's going to work. Isn't that going to just make me more angry? But I didn't have anything else to try, so I tried it. And pretty quickly I understood that it helped. Again, it's that shift. It's the difference between, oh, this is the experience of anger versus acting on it and following through on it, building that rut or that trench in the mind around anger. So putting it into practice, being willing to engage, you know, it begins to show us the value of this shift of perspective. from feeling like we have to construct things the way we want them to be, to a whole different view on our lives. And so we engage. This is the energy. We apply the energy towards what we've learned, towards the wisdom. And then patience is next. It's necessary because, you know, we'd like it to be that, oh, I've learned this thing. Let me do it. Oh, wow, I saw something. Done, finished. You know, it doesn't quite work that way. This is a long haul exploration. It takes a lot of persistence, a lot of patience the patterns of our mind, the habit of wanting things to be the way we want them to be, wanting people to think of us in a certain way, those patterns have been well grooved into our system, well trained, well conditioned into our system. And so simply seeing it once or twice is not quite enough to shake those patterns up. There's a lot more patience of seeing them over and over again, watching a pattern happen over and over again. There's wisdom that grows. We learn new things about the pattern, new ways about how it's put together. We see new, like, delusions in our mind that are just humbling and stunning. You know, that thing I mentioned earlier, in a way, you know, it's like where I saw that the anger, I wanted that person to be miserable. At one point, I saw, I mean, not at that point, at that point, that was the recognition of, oh, this is where the seeds of war are. But later on, I saw that I actually believed that my anger would make somebody miserable. You know, that I'll show them, I'll be really mad at them. You know, that was a belief in my mind. And, you know, I was fortunate in some ways because I was in the Peace Corps. I was in the middle of an island, in the middle of the South Pacific on a little tiny island, and the person I was angry with was 7,000 miles away. And it was pretty clear that my anger was not making the other person miserable. To see that belief at work, you know, that was, this was a kind of a new aha moment in my mind. It's like, wow, you know, this anger isn't making the other person miserable, it's making me miserable. It was a little aha moment. And so this, you know, that was a little aha moment. I had many, many aha moments around the anger that slowly, slowly, slowly began to weaken that pattern to the point where the anger, at some point, it took a couple of years for this particular anger at this particular person, something this person had done that was very, very painful for me, to me. And it took a couple of years, but that anger completely let go to the point where I can just have the wish that that person be happy and have no vestige of any anger at all. So this practice, while it takes energy and patience, it does open us to the truth. This next parami, truthfulness. That moment of, you know, recognizing how my mind believed, you know, I believed that it would make the other person miserable, but it was making me miserable. That was this practice of the wisdom and the energy to direct my attention to that and the patience of doing it over and over again. My mind began to understand what's really going on in there. What's really going on in there is the mind is constructing suffering for itself. And that began to really free the mind, really allow the mind to let go of that pattern. So we see the truth of our experience. We see what's actually going on in our human experience, kind of below the level of our ideas and views and opinions and judgments. We meet the truth. Then there's determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. Determination really speaks to, you know, the fact that it's kind of in the terrain of patience in a way. We really have to, you know, as we see the truth, it's really humbling. And we have to have some measure of resolve to keep uncovering the truth, keep uncovering it. Many parts of our mind do not want to see this truth. And so there needs to be some level of like, yep, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep exploring this truth because I know from the experience that this way brings a deeper and deeper happiness, a deeper and deeper peace. And we begin to touch into the heart qualities as we engage in this practice. And these ones to me really feel completely intertwined with the others. It's harder for me to put these, you know, kind of at the end. But loving kindness, you know, we as a result of practice, you know, as we really let go of the ways we've been holding and clinging and struggling to have things the way we want them to be, as we let go of that, our heart is much more connected and resonant with the world. And so it does result from the letting go. It is it's a result of our practice in a way, but it also is so entwined with everything. You know, we need in some ways to bring this quality of love and kindness to all of our work in the practice, to, you know, meeting this human experience with kindness rather than frustration and anger. And the whole of the practice is cultivating a balance of mind, of equanimity, of it's like this and it's okay that it's like this. This moment has come to be in this way. And that's okay. It's not okay, but it is understood that it is this way. There is non-resistance to that it is this way. And that non-resistance, kind of I pointed to this earlier, that non-resistance to it is this way doesn't mean that we don't take action, especially in the face of injustice. But the heart that has love and equanimity and wisdom meets the world, meets that injustice with, not with anger and hatred, but with compassionate action. And so the whole practice in some ways kind of can come back to this relationship to the world. Through this purification of our own hearts and minds, we become a better being in this world. Well, I have to stop now. So my thinking was to continue this with exploring one a week for a while and kind of going into more depth with each one so that there can be a little more time to explore each one. So I'll do that over the next months. So thank you for your attention.